today, everybody. My name's Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer. Don't you usually do Welcome to the Tactical?
Well, no. I thought you were going to take this one and run with it.
You're going to still do that stuff.
Oh my God. Okay.
I literally don't know what to say on that.
I don't know. Well, I think we should just keep recording and run with it. I think that was beautiful.
We should just keep going?
Yeah, why not? Why not?
Hey, guys, this is our first week of the podcast.
Anyway,
Dennis for longer than we've been podcasting.
Yes, this is true. Thank God. So practices, right?
Yeah, so practice. We actually want to talk about practice. So we're running with that.
Not just practices. I mean, why the way that you go out and practice tennis, not when I say you, not you, Jacob, although we've certainly had our share of bad practices, why the listener, when they go out and practice tennis, probably is doing a very bad job of it.
Yeah, so to kick this off, Australian Open was last week. Federer, 18 slams, all of that jazz. One thing really jumps out to everybody, I think, which is Federer hit more backhand winners in the fifth set than he has in the last five matches against Rafa. He was attacking just kind of constantly throughout this match, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think about it, this raises a really interesting question, right? So if you've stuck with us for the first 2 minutes here, then good job. Stick around. It's going to get better. If you watch Fed play the final, you got to bet on yourself, right? So if you watch Fed play the final against Rafa, watch him attacking, and then ask yourself, how do I practice to play this way? Not how do I practice being aggressive, because that's easy, but how do I actually organize my practice and do these things?
Right. And just to clarify that question, because I think some people might hear that and say, well, how do I practice in order to play like Federer? Well, the answer isn't to kind of go back in time and start playing tennis when you're three and, all of that good stuff. And you apparently just get a coach who gives you perfect forehand technique. We're talking about in terms of going out and being able to execute an aggressive, very well-organized game plan from start to finish. Or I guess another way to look at it is, how is your practice and the way you practice helping you actually implement the way you want to play in matches?
Yes. And
because let's look at this for a second. Between the pair of us, I've forgotten how many years. I don't want to think about how many years of coaching college tennis and then working with other players. We're talking about thousands upon thousands of practices that the two of us have, both cooperatively and completely independently from each other, that we've planned and executed
a lot. Yeah,
not going back. Yeah, we're talking about 15 years, and that's not even counting the stuff that we both did as players. We're talking about thousands and maybe 10,000-20,000 practices between the two of us.
And there have been a lot of people that have run a lot of practices. The thing that I want to point out here is that I probably spent 10 years telling you after half of the practices that you ran the 162 things that I didn't like about them, and probably spent twice that much time telling myself about how many times I messed up in practice.
Well, sure. So, I think what I was about to say is, of the thousands upon thousands of practices that we've run, so many of them were, even though they were very well organized and had a very clear intent, they just weren't good practices. And I cringe a little bit looking back now compared to the days when I first got my head college coaching gig. And it's like the way that I structured practice and the things that we spent time on, compared to how I look at practices and how they should be done now. It's so fundamentally different that
it's really tough.
Right, and so I think what we want to do today is, just take our faithful listeners, hopefully faithful after four podcasts, and give them some of the stuff that we've picked up through all these years and all these thousands upon thousands of practices, because the odds are most people listening haven't, they've been doing other different productive things with their lives. And kind of shortcut the process for them and maybe save them 10 years of making mistakes.
Yeah, hopefully you haven't put as much time thinking about these things into it as we have.
Unless tennis is your living, because in that case...
Right, you should, and then hopefully you have.
Yes, but if not, then yeah.
You talk about, and you're very candid there, so thank you for that. You talk about cringing when you look back at your practices. I cringe when I look back at my match play And Nelson, and please don't go into this too much because it's still, I mean, if I'm being honest, like it still pains me in a very real way. But, you know, realistically, I mean, I'm a much better player now than I was even when I was playing really competitive tennis. And I mean, God, like some of these things that I did were embarrassingly bad. They were so bad. But the thing that I think is important is, man, I was trying my butt off.
Sure.
Like I was giving it everything that I had, and I just wasn't as good as I could be.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't think I could ever say that I've seen somebody put as much effort into, or more effort at least, into doing things, you know, the way that you did. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the effort was misplaced, but
I think you could say you've never seen anyone put as much effort into it with so poor results.
Well,
but you know, who knows? The point being that as coaches, we're really similar in this aspect, I think, as most players are, which is, you know, hopefully you're really trying your butt off, and yet you might not be getting results that are, shall we say, commensurate with the effort level that you're putting
in. Yes, bingo. I mean, I think it comes down to a little bit of efficiency, especially most people. And even when you do look at your professional players, I mean, there's a limited amount of time that you can spend on court every day. Let's be real. I mean, you can't go out and literally hit tennis balls for 6 hours. I mean, you can, I guess, hit tennis balls 6 hours a day. But that's not going to be a very good use of your time. That's not going to be a very good way to prepare for playing competitive tennis in any facet. And so when we look at, let's say, the average recreational player who maybe plays tennis for 3 or 4 hours a week, and obviously there are recreational players at both ends of the spectrum who maybe only show up for the match, and then you've got guys that maybe play almost every day, and even professional players. I mean, the vast majority of people, you know, for the time that they're spending out on the court, they're not getting very much bang for their buck. Their practices aren't efficient, and they aren't really developing the skills that actually help them win matches.
And that's the key, is in practice – at any moment, you could stop and ask yourself, are you developing a skill? And is that skill something that's actually going to help you win matches?
Right. And I think whether I want to take – yeah.
Whether it's the match tomorrow or whether it's, you know, a match years down the road.
Right. Right. And, like, and a moment here just to shout out because I think, you know, we should mention Craig O'Shaughnessy.
Craig O'Shaughnessy, yeah.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
He's probably the loudest, most vocal person about this, about how he's probably a little bit more blunt than us. He just says you don't even know how to practice. Like, you're just not even doing the right thing.
And I think what's important, and the reason I want to give him a shout-out, is because the man has put together a wealth of data, and that data supports conclusions that you and I both came to independently over the last probably 5 years going back. It's been kind of an evolution there. But I mean, he's come up with just a wealth of data, so much data that supports exactly what we're about to say, which is that the tennis matches are decided in the first four balls.
Yeah, and Craig's got the best data in the world. And honestly, like, you can argue with him, but everybody is going to be doing this eventually. It's
right,
just a matter
right.
of time.
Yeah, I mean, and we've talked about this before. I mean, look, Craig's doing some fantastic work. We don't, just as I don't agree with everything that you say and you don't agree with everything I say, we don't agree with all of Craig's conclusions. I mean, he has some great conclusions, and he has some fantastic data. We don't agree with everything that he concludes, but I think this is one area where he's completely hit the nail on the head, which is that the vast majority of points in tennis matches are extremely short and are decided by the person who has control of the point over those first four balls. And the thing is, the reality is that most people don't practice in a way that reflects that dynamic that is going to be the way most points are played in a match, you know, which is your serve and your first ball after the serve, or your return and your first ball after the return.
So if I'm Roger Federer and I take 6 months off and my doctor says, hey, you know, you can't be out there playing these long points and changing direction 10 times and putting huge loads on your knee, I'm just guessing, but, you know, let's pretend he says that. And I say, all right, well, I'm going to spend 6 months. I'm just going to practice my serve. I'll practice my return. And, you know, I'm going to try and take control of the point.
And apparently I'm going to practice hitting flat, hard backhands cross court too.
Yeah, well, why not? You know, right. I mean, if you're only gonna be good for two or three balls.
Right. Well, I think he was good for a lot more than that. But, yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, like the idea of being more aggressive, taking more control. But this is a reality for all tennis players, not just Roger Federer. I mean, anybody. when we go and look through the matches, and again, you look at Craig O'Shaughnessy's dad, he's looking at college matches, at professional matches. It doesn't matter. The dynamic is the same basically at all levels of the sport, which is that serve and your first ball to serve, and again, return, first ball to return. And these are the things that people tend to practice the least.
Yeah, and if you're, you know, if you're skeptical, I mean, I think you should be skeptical about it. That's the way I think that you should always approach new information.
You should be skeptical about everything, but yeah.
Yeah. But if you're really like, come on, this doesn't make any sense. And I mean, Craig, go look at Craig's data, brain game, just Google it, brain game tennis or braingame.com. I'm not sure. But I mean, he's looked at more matches than anybody. It's junior tennis from 12-year-old kids all the way up through the top eight in the pros. He knows what he's talking about. That's going to be easy to overcome.
Right.
The thing that I really want to know is, okay, so I need to win the first four shots.
Right.
Serve, return, the first ball after the serve, which the server would think of as a serve plus one, and then the first ball after the return, right? So how do I organize my practice in order to work on that?
Let's talk for a moment about what typical practice looks like for most people, which is, look, we go out there, we spend maybe 3, 4 to 5 minutes hitting short the court. We're standing like 2 feet behind the service line, gently rolling pot spinner slice balls back and forth, right? Which you and I both hate, I believe. I don't speak for you. I hate it. I've always hated that people do that in practice. I've always hated that, you know, even athletes, like even college athletes and professionals that do this thing. It's like, look, you're supposed to have done a physical warm-up before you walk out in the court, first of all, right? Your shoulders should be warm. Your legs should be warm. Like, you should have blood flow to go already go into your body, right? Your wrist should be warmed up. That should happen before you hit a tennis ball if you're going to go out there and use your time on the court productively. If you haven't shown up early and taken care of that already, you've already wasted a bunch of time. And then I say, well, so what is that? What skill does that really work? What point in a match am I going to try to hit a 5 mile an hour gently rolling topspin ball that bounces up waist high at the service line? The answer to that is basically never. So, I mean, it's 5 minutes that I've just totally wasted. So after that rant over, we move on to what happens next is you and I will go out, and I'm just saying that
we'll go back to the baseline.
Go back to the baseline, and we'll maybe hit up and down the minute for a minute.
We'll definitely hit up and down. For most of our practices, or not just say like us personally, but
like
for
just
most
the average
people
yeah. So for, they'll hit up and down a little
for
bit.
For the average college, average college team.
Right, and then we'll go
hit
up some,
and down the middle for 10 minutes.
And then we'll go hit some cross-court forehands, and then we'll hit some cross-court backhands, and then we'll probably practice hitting some serves, and, you know, a variety of serves too, right? We'll hit just kind of all over the box, firsts and seconds, and then we'll play some points, right? Maybe we do some doubles drills. I don't know. You know, that depends a little bit on the coach and
you're starting to get advanced now. If you're doing doubles drills in the first 20 minutes of your practice, you're probably in
20 minutes. I was talking like in the first 2 hours, you know. But I mean, people spend literally 30 minutes warming up their ground strokes effectively, or quote unquote grooving their ground strokes, right? Working on that consistency, or that idea of consistency, and that's essentially a huge waste of time.
So how long should it take you to warm up your ground strokes?
To warm up ground strokes, I mean, I'm realistically thinking maybe 5 minutes, right? I mean, I've already warmed up my body physically, ideally. I walk out on the court. I'm going to hit maybe 5 minutes worth of ground strokes just to, you know, get that hand-eye coordination going, kind of activate all the appropriate neural networks and just kind of be there present, you know, feel the ball, you know, get that groove going a tiny bit. And then it's time to start getting productive.
Okay, so have you ever seen a professional darts player?
Professional darts player?
Yeah, you know, like have you ever watched? It's on like,
you know, I haven't.
Fox,
funnily enough,
sports,
I mean, I think
television
my
where they have like pro darts
in bars back in Australia before I was born at darts. Yeah. He was very very good. Like, but no, I never watched professionals play on television.
Okay, so how long do you think it takes someone to warm up darts?
Oh, goodness gracious. That's a good question. You know, I don't know that I know enough about professional darts to say that. I mean, do they stand the same distance away from the dartboard every time?
Every single time. You stand in one spot?
Then I'm going to guess that they take 3 throws.
3 throws. Okay. So let's say, I mean, if you're – let's maybe put it a little different. If you're a pro darts player, you can function pretty well. Like, forget what your routine is. I'm not talking about how long is your routine, because that could be – 2 minutes, that could be 2 hours. Just depends on personalities. But you're probably pretty locked in. I mean, let's say what? 10, 20 throws?
Oh, yeah. I was trying to be a little bit ridiculous. I figured you were leading somewhere. I was trying to
circumvent and
shorten the process. But
what's the difference then between, say, hitting a forehand and throwing a dart?
Well, I mean, just the physicality of it, you know, is the only difference. And that's where, again, comes back to the whole idea of if I've warmed up properly beforehand. But outside of that, I mean, there's really, you know, from a neurological perspective, there's no real difference. I mean, you're activating a sequence of muscles in a very particular order and a very particular timing.
And if you're trying to figure out, like, how to hit the ball in your warm-up, then, I mean, you're screwed.
Right, like, yeah. I mean, it's not that you're screwed. It's just that you're at a very, very early developmental stage in learning to play tennis. And that's fine. I mean, look, everybody's been there at some point. You know, but when we talk about, like, actually, you know, if you're having trouble, if you're figuring out how to hit the ball in warm-up, then, you know, hopefully you're warming up with your coach who's giving you private lessons and giving you the structure so that you can move past that stage. Right, but yeah, like, I mean, we should already obviously have some idea of how we go about hitting the tennis ball.
Remember I used to work on my technique on my backhand because it was so bad in warm-up all the time. And that's also how I knew, you know, simple strategy. Try to hit not very many backhands.
Right.
Because, you know, I'm learning in the warm-up. That tells you this is a weakness.
There's a problem there, sure.
So people are going to be confused by this whole darts thing. But the idea is that for the pros, if they've done a really good general physical warm-up, like if they're actually have done their physical prep and their body can move and everything is at the temperature it needs to be and, you know, muscles are activated if you want to get down to that level and coordination patterns are activated if you want to get down to that level, they only have to hit a few balls before they're pretty much locked in.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, at that point, you know, and not just the pro players, I mean, college players, you know, advanced recreational players. I mean, you've hit so many millions of tennis balls. All you need is just a moment to, I think, acclimatize to the air temperature, you know, the ball pressure, the court speed on that particular environment, that particular day. And that happens very, very quickly because you have so much data in your head at the subconscious level operating that, yeah, I mean, I think that happens very, very quickly. Very quickly.
So then what are we actually doing with the other like 20 or 30 minutes that we use in the warm up? If I only need to hit say 10 or 20 forehands, 10 or 20 backhands, I mean, all of that whole process takes 2 or 3 minutes. So what am I doing with the other 27
minutes?
Well,
I'm practicing being neutral in a tennis rally, which is something that basically almost never happens in an actual tennis rally.
Let's hope.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the reality is, I mean, unless you're talking about, Jill Simon playing, was it the Monfi match where they both said
Monfi, yeah.
Let's talk about that one particular Monfi Simon match where those guys literally looked like they were warming up in the middle of like at a 70-something ball rally and neither of them hit the ball above 30 miles an hour. I mean, but by and large, like, yeah, you're practicing being neutral. And that's just not a situation that ever really happens. Usually what happens is by the time the serve and return have been hit, you've got one player who is very clearly in control of the point, and he's on offense, and one player who's very clearly on defense. And even if that's not the case, and they do actually come out neutral in reasonably high-level tennis, and look, if you're listening to this podcast, either you just love listening to us talk, or you're trying to get to a higher level of tennis. In higher-level tennis, somebody has reached that point of being aggressive and force their opponent on defense within a couple shots.
Yeah.
And so the reality is we spend very little time neutral, and the vast majority of the time, either in control on offense or not in control on defense. And goodness knows, and this is part of the big point of the part of this podcast, is you want to be the guy who's in control on offense.
And the key here...
Oh, go ahead.
The key is that if you are spending a big chunk of your time hitting up and down the middle or just kind of going through the motions to quote unquote get yourself warmed up, you need to realize
I think it's past, it's not even warm up,
it's a groove.
People practice the cross court forehand, but the problem is they practice hitting a very neutral, manageable ball. They don't generally practice aggressive cross, they don't practice opening the court up, they don't practice, you know, some combination of I'm going to hit this one deep and force you back and then this one angled and pull you wide. There's not really an intent to hitting the cross court forehands, except that I'm going to make 20 in a row. Except that when you look at matches, again, when do you ever hit 20 cross court forehands in a row in a match? Hopefully never.
Hopefully never.
Hopefully never, right?
So if you're grooving, you know, if that's your thought process. And I don't care if you're top 100 ATP or WTA or if you're just starting. But if you're grooving, you should understand that what you're really doing is you're reinforcing habits.
Yes.
And you're reinforcing habits that you probably don't want if you sit down and think hard about, well, what's my goal really? My goal is to go out there and try and win the majority of points in the first four shots.
Right.
At least to get that advantage.
Right. Well, the point is, yeah, it's not even necessarily that you will win the point within the first four shots. It's that by the end of the first four shots, the person who's going to win that point is already pretty clear. The vast majority of the time, obviously people come up with great winners from very disadvantaged situations. You know, goodness knows we've seen people like Monfils and Nadal and Djokovic do this over and over and over again. But the point is, the vast majority of the time, that person who is in control of the point is going to win the point more often than not.
Yeah.
And the margins are small. I mean, at any level, if you're playing someone who's of a comparable ability to you, winning a handful more points a set is going to be the difference between winning and losing the match.
So this first got pointed out to me how I don't know what word to use here. The first thing that came to my head was foolish, how foolish my practices were. But they're not foolish. That's not what it was. It was how traditional, how like almost uninformed my practices were. I was sitting in the kitchen with a brilliant coach by the name of Steve Anacone. And we were talking about our practice and what we were doing, yada, yada. And he just he looked at me at the end of this conversation and he said, well, how much time did you spend serving? And I just kind of looked at him and got this sinking feeling that I was going to answer this question, you know, with like the wrong answer. Like I was like a kid in class about to get like abused by the professor. And I just said, well, I mean, I didn't. Like, I didn't do serving in that practice. And he said, oh, okay. He said, well, how many points in the match are determined by the serve? You know, what do you mean? Like, by my serve? Well, by your serve or by your opponent's serve. And I was like, okay. Did some quick math. For me, in my particular matches at that point in my career, it turned out it was something like 30-35% of all points were determined on the serve. And that's, I mean, that's the number I came up with.
Right.
And so I told him that. And he said, and have you spent 35% of your time working on the serve over the last 2 weeks? And I had stopped talking.
Right. Well, yeah, there's no – the point that, yeah, there's no answer that's going to make that conversation go better for you. So we've spent a fair bit of time obviously talking about what people typically do, which is to go out, they, you know, short balls, hit up and down the middle, hit some cross-court forehands, hit some cross-court backhands. I come up to net and volley, you come up to net and volley. We hit some serves. And notice when we hit serves, people just hit serves, and the other person usually either catches the ball and serves it back, or they try to guide the ball straight back to their partner so they can serve some more, right? And they're focusing on warming up the serve, but they're not really practicing the serve, and they're not really practicing the return. So let's talk a bit about, or actually let's spend the rest of the time talking about what practices should look like. Like, how should a practice start? How should a practice go? And I think maybe let's start by talking about how much time we should spend doing what, right?
Well, I think I just said something like a third of your time should be serving and returning.
Right. Well, I think we've both come to the realization it probably should be a little more than that even.
Depending on the day.
But yeah, I mean, I think somewhere between 40-50% of your time should be spent actively practicing the serve and actively practicing the return. When we say practicing the serve, I mean, it doesn't just mean, oh, I'm just going to, oh, I'm going to hit this one at the tee, this one wide, this one at the body, and now I'm going to hit a kick serve. I mean, actively practicing the serve, which, you know, to my mind, and we haven't talked about this, so maybe you will disagree with me vastly, but look, you're literally practicing a skill. Can you imagine if you said, well, I want to become like an expert piano player, so I'm just going to play 12 different songs in 12 different styles back to back to back, and if I mess up a note, oh, well, I'm just going to keep playing. No, of course, you like will practice and practice and practice little sections until you become just a master at that individual little section, right?
Yeah.
It's like serving. I mean, you've got to pick a serve, and you have to have an idea of what that serve should look like or what are you trying to accomplish with it, and then you need to hit it and hit it and hit it until you become better at it. You don't have to perfect it in one day. Right, that's not realistic. But the goal is, look, if I can get 1% better at tennis every time I walk out on a practice court, then I'm going to get a hell of a lot better at tennis pretty gosh darn quickly. You know, I mean, can you imagine, like, if I practice every day and I got 1% better at tennis every day for 2 months, I'm literally, like, significantly better. Well, I mean, but for a lot of people, that actually is possible.
Well, when you start, there's no way that high-level players can actually get 1% better.
Not every practice. But, you know, I mean, at high levels, you say, well, can I get, like, a third of a percent better, or even, you know, a half a percent
or a tenth of a percent. You know, if you're 1% better.
But the point being, like, if you have to pick some active skill and go out and work on it in a way that allows you to improve your ability to perform that skill. So you might go out and practice the wide slice serve on the deuce court and hit that, you know, a couple hundred times and actually get better at it. You know, set up some targets, have some idea of where the ball's going to come through the court. What am I aiming at? How much spin am I looking for that works for me? You know, and all these factors are going to change a bit depending on your particular service motion, how tall you are. You know, a bunch of other things, but the idea is, look, pick something very specific when you serve and hit it. And the same thing, look, don't just go out there and bunt the ball back to your opponent when you're returning, right?
Right. Practice your return. That's your time to practice. That's all you got. So I want to point something out here.
Okay. Point away.
Because I think people will be interested in it, right? For most guys, like, there's on the tour, on the men's tour at least, because the men on the ATP practice and warm up with each other. Whereas on the WTA, they're much more likely to practice and warm up with their coaches or with a hitting partner than with other WTA players. But on the men's tour, it's almost inevitably with another player. And there has become a standard warm up where it's literally hit up and down the middle for 5 minutes, maybe hit a couple of cross courts on both sides, right? And then it's going to be one guy comes up to the net and volleys, then hits overheads. The other guy comes up to the net, volleys, overheads. You mirror each other. Everybody goes through everything. And it's just like 2 minutes on this side, 2 minutes on this side, 2 minutes on this side, et cetera. And then you go to serving and you go, okay, I'm going to serve wide. Okay, I'm going to serve middle. Okay, I'm going to serve T. Okay, the other guy's going to serve wide, middle T. Okay, and then maybe every now and then someone will say, like, oh, you know, I'm going to hit some of these returns. If you've got coaches out there to shag balls, then they're more likely to actually practice and work on their own stuff. If you don't, then everything is pretty much about trying to help the other guy hit more balls.
Right.
This is in stark contrast to, say, how Djokovic warms up for a match.
Right.
Where he'll hit, like, four serves and then say, okay, return them. And you're like, what? And he's like, yeah, just like, can you just hit the return? Like, don't hit it to me. Like, actually hit the return. And then he's hitting his serve, and he'll make it easy on the other guy. So he's going to hit all of his serves wide on the deuce. Mm-hmm. So the guy knows where it's coming, and the guy's going to hit a good return then, because, come on, anybody in the top 200 returns really well when you know where the serve's going.
Sure.
And what Novak is going to do then is he's not just practicing that serve, but he's going to practice that serve and he's going to practice the plus one, the first ball, right afterwards. Right. And he's literally going serve wide, putting the ball in the corner on the next ball, it just again and again. And he's practicing that pattern with that serve again and again and again on both sides. Whatever his patterns are, that's what he's doing in his warm-up. That doesn't happen accidentally.
No, of course not. I mean, I'm pretty sure we could imagine that Federer spent a little bit of time working that pattern too.
I would think so. I mean,
understatement
of
the day.
He's probably one of the most natural guys about doing that. And if anyone doesn't need to practice that pattern as much, right?
Right.
It's probably Roger. But for everybody else in the world, like, you better be practicing those patterns. You better have a pretty good idea of what you know you actually want to do. Otherwise, you're out there just, like, reacting to things instead of really bringing a game plan.
And that's really, I think, a key factor is you've got to know your own identity as a player and what works for you, and then practice in a way that augments your ability to win points using that on the court when you play an actual match. You know, like, if you don't own the wide serve, obviously you need to work on the wide serve and get better at it. But you also have to know, like, this is my bread and butter play. Is I take a serve, let's say I jam somebody, you know, to the body, to the left hip on the deuce court, and then I'm going to set up a forehand, and I'm going to crank a forehand. Well, you've got to practice that pattern and make sure that you can execute it with your eyes closed over and over. The idea here is, look, I want to be able to go out and execute my serve plus one pattern even when I'm having a bad day, right?
Yeah.
Even when things aren't going 100% right. I've just done this so well, so often, that, you know, a mediocre job of this is still pretty gosh darn good. I'm going to win a lot of points, and I'm going to take care of my own service games doing this, or ditto on the return games where possible.
That's a
key factor.
How do you think this looks for a lot of people? They don't have the luxury, like they're not going to go out and do a 45-minute workout and then go and work with a coach before they go out to, play a set.
Well,
with
heck,
buddy,
I mean, look,
right?
The vast majority of guys playing professional tennis right now don't have an active coach out there with them in the middle of the practice, because you've got a lot of guys that just don't have the funds or the means to do that, that are very good players, or they're sharing a coach with three or four other guys. Look, I mean, I think that this looks like this. You obviously, you get some sort of physical warm-up. And the thing is, you can get an awesome physical warm-up done in 5 minutes, just by getting some squatting going, doing some lunging, some arm circles, these kinds of activities. Get those joints moving, get the muscles warm. Get out on the court. Take, 3 to 5 minutes and hit some ground strokes. You can start with your cross-court points or backhands if you want to. Point being, just find your rhythm for the day really quickly. Get the conditions going. And then, we've got to start looking at what do we want to achieve with the practice? How should I spend my time? We talked about spending 40 to 50% of the time hitting serves and returns. And this is where it gets a little bit hard for most people, because when tennis is your recreation, even if you are trying to be competitive about it, there is that element where we want to hit a lot of balls. Like instinctively, we feel like, well, if I hit a lot of tennis balls, I'm going to get better at tennis. And the problem is, to practice effectively, your actual number of balls hit has to go down. And in some cases, go down dramatically, because the way that you're going to go about practicing isn't conducive unless you you've got a third party out there.
If you want to get better, the quality has to improve.
Exactly,
you have to
the quality
learn
has to improve.
Things.
You have to practice hitting the ball really well and being aggressive with it and being able to do specific things in a way that isn't conducive to, I'm going to hit 300 balls in this hour. It's, I might only hit 60 balls in this hour, but I'm hitting 60 balls exactly the way that I'm going to hit them in a match, as opposed to the way that I would practice when I hit 300 balls of hitting lots of cross-court rallies where they know where I'm hitting, I know where they're hitting. I might hit 300 balls, but of those, only 5 or 10 might be actually like I would hit them in a match. So you've got to wrap your head around that fact and really come to terms with it, come to peace with. I'm going to go out there, and both me and my partner are going to spend a lot of time walking to the opposite corner that we were just standing to pick up a tennis ball so that we can run the drill again.
Okay. I want to interrupt you here. One, people might be thinking, I'm going to spend all my time chasing balls. It's a good use of money to have more balls.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Two,
there's that.
You threw out these numbers where you said 300 balls in an hour, 60 balls in an hour, and they're probably cherry-picked.
Yes.
But I just want to say that if you think about it, not like how many actual balls you're hitting in an hour. I mean, you're hitting more than one ball a minute. You're not going to be talking for 59 seconds and hit one ball and repeat,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, nice.
What you're saying really is you're trying to set up a certain set of circumstances where you're able to execute a very particular movement and learn something that improves your game and drives you forward. So you might have to hit 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or sometimes 100 balls in order to hit the one that gives you the feeling that actually brings you closer to being a better player.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Where the better you get, the longer this takes. So on the tour, like just 2 weeks ago, I was doing this in Melbourne with a player, and we drilled for 25 minutes, literally 25 minutes. And he was working his tail off. The drilling's going really well. And then I threw him a monkey wrench, like something totally unexpected, something that he wasn't prepared for, that we hadn't talked to, in order to get him in this one position and see how he was going to react to it. Mm-hmm. Right? He hit the shot. He executed it well. I put my racket down and I looked at him and I said, we just did all of that so you could hit that one ball like that. And he looked at me and was like, oh. And it made perfect sense to him in the moment, because, of course, he had the feeling. He had never hit that shot before, and it was a big deal for him. And then the next day we're able to, instead of just hit it one time, he was able to hit it 10
replicate
times.
Replicate it. Yeah, exactly. 'Cause, yeah.
But literally 25 minutes of – I mean, I went through – so we're feeding out of a box, so it's like 70 balls at a time. But I went through 7-8 boxes to set up that one shot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, this is not like, if you looked at how I practiced when I was 25, let me tell you, It was not like that.
Sure. Well, I mean, the idea here is obviously you're trying to expand your skill set. You're trying to learn to do something new. And there's an element of experimentation there. There's an element of searching, you know, trying to find a better way to do things. I do want to point something out really quickly, too, before we talk any further about this, is the vast majority of pros practice this way. It doesn't mean that it's the right way to do, or the best way. It doesn't mean it's the optimal way to do things.
Right. You optimal know? Being the key word.
Right.
Optimal, lots of, because it's what most people do.
Right.
But it's just what we've always done.
Right, exactly. I mean, you look at, there's some players that are really starting to evolve the way that people train and practice. I mean, Djokovic would be an example. Rajonic is another example of a guy, as we've talked about previously, yeah. who's doing things in a very unusual way, but getting great results as a whole. I think certainly nobody can say that he's not going to maximize on his talent or isn't already maximizing his talent the way that we've seen him improve steadily and predictably. Yeah. I mean,
well, he's a guy who – and I don't think people talk about this that much, but like his forehand is demonstrably better than it was when he started on the tour.
Oh,
his backhand is
his returns. I mean, every this is I talk about, you know, really, that whole. Well, but here's the thing: he's the guy who's, I think, consistently gone out and found that 0.5% here, 1% there, 1/3% there, 0.1% there. I feel like he's a guy who gets a little bit better every time he steps out in the court. We see it, you know, we've seen it. And it shows up in his results. But that's probably a whole other conversation about the stability with which he's risen to the top five is phenomenal. It's like sure. it's beautiful, really, the way that he's just gone and consolidated his game at every step of the way. There's not been these big dips and furrows and rises. And, you know, it's just been a very predictable steady rise. But anyway, coming back to this whole idea of, you know, just because the pros do it doesn't mean that, or most pros do it, doesn't mean there isn't a better way to do it. You know, there's always a better way. People, you know, once upon a time, you just look at Pete Sampras and say, oh, my God, that forehand is the best forehand ever. Or Agassi's backhand is the best backhand ever. You know, and now we've got Roger Federer, you know.
Some people still think Andre's backhand was the best. Well, but definitely Federer's forehand is better than Pete's.
Oh, it's not even and funny. And I was
as big of a Pete fan as I got.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's not even funny how much better Federer's forehand really is. When you look at what he can do with the ball. And that's just a genuinely better way of hitting a tennis ball. But, you know, there was once upon a time when people weren't even thinking about that as being a possibility. So be willing to try something new. Be willing to accept, look, this is how we should be practicing. And let's get back to the point here. So, you know, we should go out and after we've kind of very briefly warmed up, you know, we should – personally, I like to get into the serves and returns after a little bit of working on other skills.
Yeah.
You know, I just feel like I'm going to hit better serves and better returns that way, and the quality of that practice is going to be better. But, you know, we should look at what skills actually take place in a match, you know. Instead of just hitting cross-court forehand, cross-court backhand, set up a drill where, you know, like you're going to feed me a short mid-court forehand. I'm going to take that into the ad-court corner, come into the net, we're going to play that point out, for example. Right. You know, that's a very specific scenario that's going to come up a lot in matches, right? And then I get to practice a shot that is hugely important, which is a short forehand in the middle of the court. You know, I'm missing that shot or I'm not taking advantage of that shot, then I'm leaving a huge number of points on the table, and the odds of me winning that match, if the other guy is taking care of his end, are very low, right?
Yeah.
Likewise, my partner is getting to practice a very important defensive skill set, which is the backhand passing shot. You know, and then I'm getting to practice my positioning, my first volley. And this is a huge number of directly match applicable skills that we're both practicing in a, you know, relatively short period of time, like in a handful of seconds, we're both hitting multiple points along the way. And yes, you know what, that's the shot density is going to be lower than if we just drew across court forehands, across court backhand, but the applicable to matches shot density is going to be significantly higher.
So that's, you know, if you look at the math, you can say, well, I want to hit as many balls as I possibly can in this amount of time. And it's like, well, do you really want to hit as many balls as you can? Just stand 6 inches from the net and volley back and forth, you know, but that's right. Not going to. So that logic obviously doesn't hold. The idea really is I want to hit as many match relevant balls as I can, yes, in this amount of time.
Yes.
And the truth is that it's just a hard thing. It's not a super fast, easy thing to do.
No,
it takes setup. It takes balls.
And it takes a commitment too, because it's very easy just to not take the time to do it, you know, because you don't get to run around quite as much. There is, you know, a degree of focus required to stay on task and keep practicing the skill to get better at it. But, you know, I think like after you've done that very initial warm-up, we pick a very direct skill that we want to work on and set that scenario up and run it for a little while and get some volume in practicing that those very kind of match-specific skills, match-specific shots, and then I would move into my serves and returns. And not just serves and returns, obviously, we want serve plus one, return plus one. So I would think take some time working specific serve with a specific return. Right, so I might work the wide serve in the deuce court, and you might practice that forehand return or backhand if you're a lefty. And we'd practice those skills for a little while and then slowly open that up to start to add in that plus one ball where I'm hitting the serve, you hit the return, I'm taking that ball to the next corner. And then
all right.
Vice versa with the return.
So let me ask you what you think about this.
Yeah.
Because I know that obviously I'd ask you a question, but I'm going to cut you off anyway. So I had a team, a college team, that will go unnamed because they voiced their opinion against this very loudly for the first couple of days that I did it. But we sat down and we had a conversation similar to this with the whole team and a whiteboard and some film, and it was great. And we came to this conclusion that one of the things that we want to work on in practice is we want to hit the ball in the court, but not in the middle.
Okay.
Nice and easy, right?
Sure.
Don't hit it in the middle, because hitting the ball in the middle mostly was leading to people losing points.
Yeah, tends to do that.
Then we looked at our practice and said, well, we spend 25% of all practice time hitting the ball into the middle of the court. So we're going to flip this on its head. And what we did was we said, you're going to go out and do your warm-up. Here's the rule. You're not allowed to hit any ball in the middle.
Okay.
And they looked at me like I was an alien. And people literally wanted to revolt, right? But they did that, okay? And we did that, say, for a week. Literally couldn't hit the ball into the middle of the court. If you hit the ball into the middle of the court, you caught it and restarted whatever you were doing.
Right. Because otherwise you're spending time literally practicing hitting balls into the middle, which what's going to happen when, you know, you're on the run and you're under stress.
You're going to hit in the middle.
You've got to go back to your comfort zone.
And I told them specifically, think of it like this. If you hit a ball in the middle, you lost that point. You lost that drill, whatever it was. You know, we did a lot of competitive stuff. So one of the things that happens is when we take out hitting the ball back and forth to each other, we had a lot more fun because everything we were doing was games, was competition of some sort.
Sure.
It was much more active. So there was less like what I'm going to call kind of like lazy time, like chill time, you know, where I'm just kind of doing the easy stuff.
Yeah.
But it was way more actually entertaining and fun and bonding.
It's much more dynamic at the end of the day, you know. I mean, it's just a much more interactive practice. You're going to obviously have a very different – I mean, it's you can't check out. Like, you're hitting cross-court forehands. It's so easy to let the mind wander and not be present in the moment. And, you know, I think once you start making things much more kind of competitive and more dynamic and more engaging, people are just going to be more present. And again, I think that just, you know, you and I both obviously have talked a lot and read a lot and learned a lot about the whole neurology of learning. And,
right.
And you know, when you're present and engaged, you are going to learn better.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say this bluntly. If you disagree with that statement, then you're an idiot.
You know? No, that's
and
not
you don't,
true.
And you don't that's know what just, you're talking about. Well, okay. You're ignorant.
You don't know what you're talking about.
You don't know what you're talking about. Okay, you may not be an idiot. But yeah, you just don't know the facts. You are just ignorant.
Or you're just playing devil's advocate and you don't actually disagree with it, which is like what I would do. You know?
Well, yes. Yes, you would.
So this is why I had to defend the idiots, because it's like, no, I'm not being an idiot. I'm just giving you a hard time. So back to my question. Here's the rule. You're not allowed to hit the ball in the middle of the court.
Right,
so you've got to hit it.
But okay.
Like over, you know, to the side by a sideline, or you've got to spread the court in some way. You still have to warm up your ground strokes. So what do you think of this? Literally, I told them, like, you weren't even allowed to warm up your ground strokes hitting up the middle.
Mm-hmm.
No exaggeration. I mean, I completely took it out. What do you think? Was this, like, a good idea? Was this
I think that's a great idea. You know, one of the things that I used to do a lot of was get people to play cross-court, like, competitive games to warm up, you know? It's like, hey, you're only allowed to hit cross-court forehands. It has to be a forehand, and you only get this part of the court.
For their actual
– And then you're playing – yeah, for the actual – and you're playing to seven, go. And that's their warm-up, is trying to beat the snot out of each other cross-court.
So the warm-up was actually straight into like what I would think of as a competitive drill.
Oh, absolutely, because if they're physically warm and, you know, maybe I've given them 2 minutes to hit balls, why not? why not? You know, because these are directly applicable skills. Like, I don't need to go out and practice somebody hitting at me 50% speed and me hitting back 50% speed so I can go out in a match and hit the ball at 90% speed and have to handle somebody else's 90% ball. How, you know, practicing 50% isn't going to give me the skill set to be able to handle people's 90-100% ball. So why would I spend most of my time with the 50% ball? So, yeah, get them out there, and that's part of their warm-up. Like, get out there and crack some forehands. Get out there, crack some backhands. Now let's get out there and crack some up the line shots and approach shots and volleys. I mean, you know, there was this whole period where we were just doing warm-ups that were all about competitive games where they basically out-hit each other cross-court forehands, out-hit each other cross-court backhands competitively, and then had to take turns hitting approach shots and playing the point out as their warm-up. You know? I mean, I think it's anything that gets you out of practicing skills that don't help you in matches is a positive thing.
But these probably weren't high-level players.
Well, the people I'm talking about, yeah, I mean, these are college players.
But, I mean, it was probably like a really bad college, right?
This
was a nationally ranked team. So.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's just about using that time well. I mean, like, if you've got a limited amount of time on the court, use every minute of that time well. You know, so if we start looking at the breakdown, you know, if we spend 40% of our time actively practicing serves and returns, if we spend, let's say, another 30% of our time actively practicing short balls, you know, and first volleys, and maybe partnering with our partner who's hitting cross court first hitting pass shots,
first volleys.
Yeah, right. You know, because I mean,
a lot of people don't even practice that ever, much less. I mean, you practice volleys and you practice ground strokes.
Right,
you
but people practice volleys standing at the net, and it's like, well, okay. That's all well and good, but how many times do I get to hit that volley? And by the time I hit that volley, the point's probably already been decided. You know, I mean, those transition volleys are what – this is the thing at the end of the day. I mean, the thing that decides matches is your serve, your return, your transition game, which means that short ball and or first volley, and then your overhead. And if you can execute those things well, then you're going to have a pretty good day. And if you can't, then it's going to be a pretty rough day. So, you know, think about spending 40% of time set of return, 30% of time working on transition / defense. You know, I think probably 10 to 15% on overheads, just flat out overheads. I mean, I think it's just a shot that you have to be able to execute at a very high level and know. Look, this is the thing to me. Like, and try this yourself. Just go and Google Roger Federer missed overhead, and tell me that you can find a video anywhere. No, but I mean, I'm serious because I actually did this the other day to prove a point to somebody, and I hadn't done it prior to this. I asked them to do this, and I'm sitting there the whole time like, please, dear God, let the first video come up not be Roger Federer missing an overhead, right?
Right,
because that would be embarrassing. But so I Googled Roger Federer missed overhead. On my computer with the person in the room with me, flipped the screen around and showed it to them. And, like, it's just page after page of other people missing overheads while playing against Roger Federer.
Right, yeah.
You just can't find – I mean, I literally, in the last 12 to 15 years, I can remember one time of him missing an overhead. Just like I remember the one time I saw him fall over on a tennis court.
Wait, when did he fall?
It was on grass. He slipped. It was like 2 years ago. I still remember I just had that moment of shock. I was like, what just happened?
I've never seen him fall.
Yeah, everybody. Yeah. It was like that thing where everybody was like, I remember the courts were slick and everybody was falling over like multiple times. Like Federer's opponent had fallen a bunch already and he slipped that once. And I was just like,
I bet there's somebody on YouTube that does like the collage videos and stuff that could put together a video of literally every single missed overhead in Fed's career, like since he was in the top 100.
Oh, easily. It would be a very short video because you're probably
like 100 shots.
I don't think he's missed 100 overheads in 1,000 matches.
That would be, yeah, he probably, I mean,
I literally do not think that he's missed 100 overheads in 1,000 matches.
That's one missed overhead every other tournament.
Yeah, I'm not sure that he has. I just, like, I've watched the guy play a lot of times. I just can't remember. I can remember once seeing him miss an overhead. Like, it just doesn't happen. But point being that, like, him and Nadal's the same way. Nadal is a machine when it comes to the overheads. Yeah. You know, who was originally a quote-unquote clay court specialist, the man has an amazingly good overhead. And I think that's...
He always wins. If he gets to hit a smash,
it's over.
He always wins the point. And
Fed's the same way. Like,
he's losing the match.
I think that this is a very underappreciated and overlooked aspect of both of their success.
Do you know the quote I shouldn't say the quote, but do you know the brief story about Nikolai Davydenko in the press conference and talking about the Smash?
No, I do not.
He was like, I want to say like 30 in the world. And they were asking him, you know, what do you need to do? Get to the next level, you know, next couple of tournaments, improve and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. And I kid you not, he said, I need to work on my Smash. Like, I'm going to work on my Smash, and it's going to take probably a couple months, but I'm going to come back, and I'm going to be top 10 in the world. And keep in mind, Davydenko had this, like, amazing career where he's 5 in the world. I think he got higher. He's beaten everybody. Like, we know now he was able to achieve some unreal results. But at this time coming up, he's – I mean, the guy weighed like 150 pounds dripping wet.
Right.
He's this tiny guy, you know, premature balding, didn't have anything great, didn't have a great serve, didn't really hit the ball as big as a lot of guys. Like, he moved well.
He's like a skinny Brad Gilbert.
People were like, oh, yeah, I mean, you move well and, like, you make balls, but, I mean, come on, you're not a top 10 player, right? And he literally, with a straight face, just told the whole media room, well, I mean – obviously, like my Smash needs to get better, and then I'm, you know, top 5.
Right. Well, he wasn't wrong.
Yeah. People did not take him seriously at all. And at the end of the year, what happens?
Yeah.
He's not missing Smashes. Smash is good. That means he can come forward now. It means his transition game has gotten better. It means you can't get those free cheap points off of him. And all of a sudden, the guy's like finishes the year at like number 7.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a game changer. And people just don't practice it enough. And the flip side of that, too, that people don't think about is that if I'm practicing overheads and you're back there practicing the lobs, those lobs can come in very, very handy when match time comes. You know, because, you know, when you just get that sheer volume of hitting lobs to somebody, and I found this with my own game, was that your ability to gauge that distance and control the depth of the lob gets significantly better. And then, you know, just your defense improves dramatically. So that's really an amazing thing to be able to do is if just you're sitting there hitting the lobs and they're hitting the overheads and you just get that rhythm going, and especially if they practice hitting the overhead off to the side, one side or the other. I mean, I think that's a great way to spend some time every practice.
And this might sound really easy, but I want to point out that Davydenko was already like top 50 in the world. And he's saying, you know, my Smash isn't very good and it's really holding me back.
Right.
So if you flip that on its head, I mean, these guys are getting to top 50 in the world, and they haven't really, in a sincere, thoughtful way, addressed their Smash.
Right. And I do want to point out the outlier, Novak Djokovic, who's not just made number one, but obviously, you know, had significantly great success up there.
Yeah, he's
with maybe the worst Smash of anybody to ever reach number one in the world. Can you think of anybody who has a worst overhead?
I mean, that's what I'm trying to.
Agassiz was pretty solid.
Agassiz was good, and it's back. Agassiz backhand overhead was like,
yeah, it's very good too.
Unbelievably good.
Yeah, almost as good as Pat Rafter's. But
wait, did Pat reach number one? Oh yeah,
yeah, Pat did. Yeah. No, but I mean, in terms of the straight up overheads, I mean, you know, like there's the Joker Smash, and it's, you know, it's pretty terrible. But the guy does so many other things amazingly well. The reality is for Djokovic, the vast majority of the time when he comes to the net, I mean, it's cleanup duty. He's not up there digging out ankle high volleys on a regular basis and then running backwards and putting away the overhead.
No, so let's talk about Novak for a second, because if you think about it, if he had Rafa's smash, okay, which Rafa's not even left-handed, so.
Right.
I would think that Novak could learn Rafa's smash. He's like very good.
And Novak's smash has gotten a little better in the last year or two, but also I will know his serve has improved as well. And I think there's a link there, but continue. Sure.
But it's still a weakness. But if that smash was better, I mean, he's improved his volleys tremendously since when he came onto the scene. I mean, we forget sometimes how young Novak was when he broke into the top 10. Like, he was a really young cat.
Still not thrilled with his volleys, but yeah, continue.
Right. And you know, the forehand volley is actually not bad. I'm really not thrilled with the backhand volley.
I'm just, you know,
It depends on what you're nitpicking on and how you're attacking it and stuff. Like, the bottom line is his game backs it up so tough that it's pretty hard to pick on those things.
Right.
He's not putting himself in those situations.
Well, the thing is, Djokovic knows which side of the bread he's putted on. I mean, like,
Yes. He's not going to put himself up there. And so this is exactly the point I want to get to, which is he could be so much more aggressive if he really had a good, solid, dependable overhead. Not the best overhead in the world, just good, solid, dependable, get it out of the middle.
I honestly, to God, think that it could be a slam. You know, like he could have an extra slam or two under his belt right now, just from a better overhead.
Oh, yeah.
Not just have gotten higher fast. I mean, like, literally could have one or two more slam titles if his overhead was stronger. Honestly, it sounds ridiculous to say, but maybe even more. You know, it's such a game changer. So, I mean, this is another thing you just have to spend time practicing. And I think it's a skill that almost nobody really practices. They warm it up, similar to the way they warm serves up, but nobody practices it. And like the two things I think nobody really actively practices virtually ever is actively practicing the return and actively practicing the overhead. I just think those people just don't do it at all. And it's so critically important. So breaking it down again, we've got roughly 40% on the serve and return, talking about 30% in transition game, you know, 10 to 15% on overhead. And then that leaves you another 10 to 15%, maybe as much as 20% to work on some other aspect that needs work. It might be a very specific type of approach, or it might be a very specific type of defensive shot. But the trick is you've got to go out and set up the scenario and practice it. And maybe you set up the scenario and you run through it slowly a few times with everybody playing kind of at 50, 60% to get the idea of this is what I want to be doing. And then you speed it up until you're running it at full speed and you're able to execute it at full speed. But you've got to be very directed. You have to be very conscious and intentful with the time you spend in the practice court. You know, there's just no two ways around it.
And that's the key, is conscious, directful, intentful, have an intent. And then, you know, I mean, if you're an average player, you can figure out, okay, what do the patterns look like in my matches? And how do I set something up to practice? And if you just do that with intent every day that you're out there, you're going to find they keep improving. Your patterns keep improving. Your knowledge of all this stuff keeps improving. And I mean, you know, we're using really easy example. I mean, let's be real, right? Like, we were trying to keep this so it's like really easy to talk about. Mm-hmm. But to really answer these questions, like, what does your practice look like? It starts to get pretty sophisticated pretty quickly, because it's all individualized.
Sure.
And it's all about what the patterns are for that player.
Right.
And all your percentages on how much time you spend on different things.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, like, I think that the general ideas here are, you know, I think the general percentages we've broken down are pretty good. And I mean, and this is the simple thing that I put to you is know what your strength is off the ground. I'm just going to assume that not many people out there are going to be serving volleying. And if you do, obviously this is going to change this dynamic a little bit. But know what your strength is off the ground. Figure out what serve I want to hit in order to be able to hit that strength as the first ball after the serve, and then practice doing so. If I want to hit forehands, then figure out how I'm going to serve, get a forehand, and do something. And this is something that Federer is just the absolute master at, is serve plus one, with that plus one being a forehand. And he knows how to get that forehand for the first ball with on each side against everybody he plays. Because if he doesn't, like, it's a completely different match for him.
And if you hit a great return against Fed, where he's not going to hit a forehand, that's what a great return is. Like, if you make him hit a backhand on the first ball,
like, you're literally four times as likely to win the point.
First of all, if you look at it from Fed's perspective, though, what's he do on that very next shot, which he wanted to be a forehand? He's hitting some sort of shot so that on the next ball, he does get the forehand he wanted.
No, absolutely.
Like, you can't make him hit two backhands in a row.
I mean, you can, but you have to be very stinking good.
You probably win the point like 90-something percent of the time if you do that.
Yeah, Rafael Nadal, every time other than the Australian final. And Addison Wimbledon matches too. But, you know, yeah, but that's a very good observation, in that it's not just obviously the serve plus one, return plus one, though those things are critical. It's also knowing, look, if this is my strength, how do I get play back onto my strength as quickly as possible? And that's probably something for a whole nother podcast. But I think that's probably a good place to wrap up for today.
Yeah, there's so many different little
nuances and things to talk about when it comes to practices. Yeah. I mean, like, this is a constantly – I mean, look, I would run a practice today differently than I would run it a week ago. And hopefully a year from now, it would still look very different. It's constantly evolving. Like, I mean, I think that it has to be for us to be able to get the most out of practice and the time spent. But look,
it does. I want to hear from you guys, like anyone who thinks that we're totally full of it on this, like,
or just have questions. Yeah, shoot us an email, glenn@tactical.tennis.
Jacob@tactical.tennis.
And if there's something that you want to hear us talk about or you have questions, I mean, I think we can easily add a little Q&A portion at the end or beginning of every podcast. More than happy to do so, but happy to have you tuning in. Again, you can subscribe to us on iTunes. Obviously, listen directly from the website, tacticaltennis.com. And hope you guys have a good and fruitful week of practice ahead.
Just one more thing that I have to say.
Okay, fire away.
Rise up, Atlanta. Rise up.
Did they win? Is it over?
It's not over.
Oh, okay. Well,
but let's hope.
Here we are recording in the middle of the Super Bowl.
Recording in the middle of the Super Bowl. That's when you know that, you know, kind of
priorities are straight, right? Something like that. Yeah, let's run with that. All right, folks, have a good week. and we'll catch you next time on Tactical Tennis Podcast.
Later, guys.